Hello, and welcome to the 50-Minute Hour. I'm Dr. Zachary Friedman, licensed clinical psychologist and your guide and liaison to mental health and its treatment. Welcome back. Part two of a two-parter episode on psychodrama, my interview with Dr. Brittany Lakenstar. This is the second half, so if you haven't listened to episode 8, this is not going to make any sense. So feel free to pause here, go back, listen to that episode, and then come back. We'll all just be waiting for you. This second half backs up just a smidgen to the end of where we left off in episode 8, where I was asking Dr. Brittany Lakenstar about the example we were talking about. We go into a lot more things. We go into a whole other example that talks about psychodrama in a group. We talk about movies. We talk about TV. She also talks about other components of psychodrama, including sharing, which is the last part of psychodramatic work. So we'll get all of that in there. One bit of follow-up, Dr. Lakenstar and I were talking after the prior episode aired, and she was highlighting actually what I think is a much better example of doubling. I had previously talked about Jim Gaffigan doubling the audience, again, voicing what is not being said or expressed by somebody. And she mentioned, and I had never thought about this before, Keegan-Michael Key, who you may know from Key and Peele. He was on Mad TV. He played Donna's husband on Parks and Rec. He's been in many movies and television, so you've likely heard of him by now. He plays Luther, President Obama's anger translator. So again, voicing and expressing what President Obama is not. And there were several Key and Peele sketches about that. He also actually made an appearance at the 2015 Correspondents' Dinner. So if you have a minute, you should go check that out because it's really a fantastic example of doubling. So that's it. Now we're going to move into the second and final half of my interview with Dr. Brittany Lakenstar on psychodrama.
Absolutely. And that's the key point, right? It's healing in relationship. And Marina also said we get injured in relationships and we heal in relationships. Yeah. And so we need to experience the relationships, and sometimes we need to practice that on the stage before we can practice it and feel safe enough to practice it in our actual relationships. And that's another really important part about psychodrama, that psychodrama can be used really for anything, right? So you can have a conversation with your anxiety, with, you know, your cancer diagnosis, with your dad, with someone who passed. It doesn't matter. You can also look at something we call role training. So training a certain role that is not yet strengthened. So maybe mm-hmm. the role of confidence or assertiveness. You know, someone might come in and say, you know, every time I go and talk to my boss, I get really anxious. I'm not feeling confident. I want to strengthen that role. Or someone might say, I really need to be more assertive with my mother-in-law, and I don't know how to do that. And so psychodrama also lets them practice that, practice new skills until they become really comfortable and part of their own role.
That's a piece about, you know, again, part of the point of this is not just it's not just feeling better. It's about, you know, having, you may have a catharsis where you're able to get angry, you're able to cry. But it's also the change in your behavior outside of the fact, or outside of the fact, outside of the room. So you go in group and it might be voicing something to your, a sibling that died, you know, and they've been dead for 6 years, 7 years or whatever. And you're able to voice all those things. It obviously, you know, in reality, sibling is still dead. So it's, you know, I think some people are like, well, what's the point of that? Well, you know, whatever, they're still dead, it doesn't matter. But I think it's complex in the sense that not only are they feeling better about that, but it might, and you're talking about the role part, about maybe that helps them be more assertive. So it's not just, oh, you deal with that grief and you're good to go. It is about the changes that happen outside. You don't have, how life changes when you don't have that kind of burden of these feelings and these issues and these injuries that haven't been dealt with. So even in the context of this person being like, oh, I was finally able to say to my sister, brother, whoever, you know, I was really mad at them for their, let's say they died of a drug overdose. Like, I was really mad about them for their drug use and that they never listened to me. And then again, the person's still deceased. So after that, you know, what's their life like if they don't have crushing grief, you know, or guilt that they might start interacting different with their partner? They might start interacting different at work or at school or whoever. Does that make sense? That kind of that it's not just about feeling better, that there's many ways where change can happen outside of the room.
Right. And speaking of change, we look for change within the psychodrama, and then we look for change to generalize outside into everyday life.
Sure.
So for example, oftentimes I have patients that want to work on communication and how to communicate in a way that's healthy. And so I'm going to give you an example, which is kind of a combination of just many different cases, obviously for confidentiality. But so I've had people come to group, say it's a young man and he wants to talk to his dad. And he's having conflict because dad really wants to be helpful, but every time he calls his dad when he's in distress, dad says things to him that are unhelpful. So he'll call up and he'll say, you know, work's not going well, and, you know, I'm just really exhausted, I'm tired. And his dad will be like, well, you know, are you going to church? You know, maybe you should go to church, or why don't you go on a dating website, you know? And it's not what he wants. And so then the son becomes very angry and says, you know, you're not helping me, and screams and hangs up the phone. And that's their pattern. That's their dance. So he comes
Absolutely,
in and he
yeah.
says, I want to figure this out. And so what you can do is do this role training with him, where then you would have him try on new things that he could say to his dad and see how he then reacts in the role of his dad. And you can also involve the group in this and have the group come be him and try on different things that he might say while he's in the role of dad. So he gets to hear all these different ideas of how he can tell his dad more of what he needs, right? Because dad's trying to be helpful, but he doesn't know how. And son's going into anger and doesn't know how to express it in a different way about, hey, dad, that's not helpful, or this is what I need to say. And so in these cases, after they practice for a while, they usually come up with a couple of things that they can say that the dad will be able to hear. And so it might be, you know, dad, I know you really want to help, but when you say go to church, you know, it makes me feel like I'm not getting listened to. It makes me feel sad because you know I don't go to church, and that doesn't feel helpful. What would feel helpful to me is you just listening and saying, you know, you got this, or I'm here for you. And giving dad, and each parent's different, so each drama will be different, but giving that parent specific things to say. And so then usually what happens is they will, in that moment, be able to come up with a couple of things that they feel like they can actually say to their dad and that dad can hear. And then you see the change then that happened in that drama right then and there.
Sure, yeah.
And you have them, you know, do that scene again with these new changes and see how that feels. And then the hope, and what usually happens, is that they'll go out of the group and they will actually try that out, and they'll come back and they'll report in a later group. And so I've had patients come back and say, you know what, I was really upset, I called dad, he went into his usual thing, I actually practiced some of the things that
we learned
in here, and I told him that, and he said okay, and he just listened, and it was so great. And so then son doesn't hang up on him, and they have this really positive moment that wouldn't have happened had he not gotten a chance to practice these skills.
Yeah.
And so that is also, again, some of the magic that can happen, but that we're looking for change. We're not just looking for you to cry or you to get angry or express yourself, but it's also, how is that going to change your everyday life?
So let me ask you this. I really like the example you gave, because I think it is a good ideal situation that, again, in that example, that son is responding differently to dad, and that creates the change. Plus, he has the practice of being able to be more assertive, or the wording, all those things, more comfortable, more warmed up for that that exchange, that role. However, here's a question I have for you: what about when you have the other person that doesn't have that different interaction? One hopes there's going to be a different, but let's say you have a mom Right. So let's say you have a mom who's always been critical of this person, right? Of their son, right? So the mom's super critical. The whole life of this son is just like, oh, you're not doing enough. You got a B. Why didn't you get an A? You know, that kind of chronic, what can be construed sometimes as chronic trauma. Very critical, very cutting the person down. So now they're coming into psychodrama and they're like, man, my mom's been really critical. I want to bring mom in the room. What happens when you have, okay, the person's talking to their mom and maybe the contract is, I want my mom to really hear me. I want my mom to really understand. She never understands because she's so defensive. She's very critical. So then you're doing as we talked about before. So you have to pick somebody to be mom and then they warm that person up. So you reverse them. This person, we'll call him Tommy. So you reverse Tommy into his mom. So then you meet mom, we interview mom, and Tommy's as his mom. So then Tommy's picked somebody. He's picked Susan to be his mom or whatever. I'm just thinking so to clear for the name so we're talking people around. Right. So now Susan's like, got it. I got the role. I'm good to go. Right. So now you have two chairs in there and the scene is they're at his childhood home where mom is, right? So they start to have this exchange and Tommy starts saying, you know, mom, and here's what's going on. I always think you're very critical. And then when reversed back into his mom, you know, let's say this type of person, his mom is somebody who is not going to change, is still going to be that critical person, is going to be, you know, even when you try to double them at, you know, so Tommy as mom. And Tommy's being like, well, I don't care. And, you know, my son needs to listen to me and da, 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 da. And you as the facilitator and the director tried to double that, you know, Tommy's mom, can I double you? And she's like, okay, why? I don't care. Cause Tommy's, that's the role that Tommy knows. So then you say, oh, you know, I'm feeling pretty vulnerable. And her response back is, I'm not feeling vulnerable at all. Mm-hmm. You know, like the double doesn't really land. And again, right. This is a person who is an intractable type because there are people that are around that are like that are in these folks' lives. So how do you, because then it's just a repeated dynamic. Then it's just Tommy's mom is critical and Tommy's stuck in there and Tommy, whatever his response is, he gets mad, he ignores her, he puts distance, cut off, whatever his response is. So does that example make sense? Like how would you, because I can imagine Tommy in the role of mom being like, that's just what she would say. She would be stuck there. She would never say, I'm sorry, et cetera, et cetera. So how would you approach that?
Right. So there's a couple of things. Sometimes you can sort of pull down an imaginary curtain and ask that auxiliary, okay, no one else can hear you right now.
You mean ask the auxiliary or would you ask Tommy?
Well, Tommy in the role of
the
auxiliary.
So Tommy's still in the role of mom. Got it.
Right. And say, so no one else can hear us right now, mom. I'm going to double you. You know, this is too hard to hear right now. And see if maybe in the role, mom would admit that with the curtain down, no one else could hear. But sometimes there's parents who have been so stuck in kind of the abusive role and they're just not able to hear.
Yeah.
And again, that happens sometimes. A lot of times, even parents who have been really abusive, we learn that deep down, you know, they'll say, I didn't know how to parent. I'm sorry. That's what I got from my parents. I didn't know any other way. And there'll be some remorse. But sometimes they're still stuck and they're not healthy. And so then it's about sort of you can silence the role of mom and so that the protagonist can just express himself without her talking back and being really critical. Or you could also sit mom to the side and maybe have him show her how kind of the ideal mom might react.
So then you would warm another person up too. This is Tommy. Tommy, pick somebody to be your ideal mom and they would have that. And then you would likely go through that whole exchange. So Tommy as ideal mom would say, well, I'm making it up, but like, oh, I love you. I've always been so proud of you and stuff like that. Then you have that's what's coming
or
up.
Or might be
my
able
head.
To take responsibility.
Oh, OK, sure.
For what she's done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess I just like I've talked with folks where I've worked sometimes where I have felt stuck, where I think that it sounds great and you can have this change or whatever, but some of these people that people have been injured by that they're bringing into the room are people that are intractable and they're not going to change, and they're ill in their own right or whatever. Again, as you right. talked about, they're overdeveloped in the abusive role that I think people sometimes, before even thinking about wanting to do psychodrama, is like another kind of like, well, why should I even do that? Is being in that role, they're not their mom, their dad, their brother or whatever is not going to say the things. Mm-hmm. So then it's kind of like, well, what is the point? Because that in that role, they're going to get stuck. So that's why I wanted to highlight that. I think that's good about bringing an ideal, trying to do some doubling, trying to explore that. Because I have seen that happen where people are just like, no, they're that stuck and they won't move.
Right. And that's when you can then have them show that parent who's stuck, you know, how they've hurt them and have them watch that, or the part of the parent that is stuck. You know, sometimes you might have a parent who's been alcoholic for 25 years of the child's life and at age 30 is sober. So it's been 5 years of sober mom or dad, and there's a lot of anger, but now they're also sober, so they're beginning to have a nice relationship, and it's hard to express that. So it might just be, we're going to take out the part of the mom that's the alcoholic mom, and we're gonna let alcoholic mom see how she has hurt the protagonist, and the protagonist will show her some of the things that happened in those 25 years where she was drinking so that she can bear witness to that. And then from there, some healing can happen, possibly for the protagonist. So yes, sometimes even in the psychodrama, the parents or the perpetrator, right, they're not going to take responsibility, and that's not the goal either, but it's to give the protagonist a voice and a chance to express things that haven't been expressed, and have support around them and safety, and also get to have a reparative moment if that's what's needed, because there's a lot of ways that we can create a nice repair for the protagonist, something by showing mom what should have happened, or talking to their little self when, you know, how wonderful is it if you're 8 years old and you're getting bullied at school and your adult self shows up to say,
sure,
you know what, this is gonna pass, and I know this is really bad right now, but you're gonna go on and you're gonna make friends and you're gonna be really cool in high school and you are gonna, you know, play soccer and you're gonna grow up and you're gonna be a teacher too, and to have that, and that can happen in the surplus reality.
So, and then again, the hope is that, again, let's assume this person is alive, the critical mom, that they leave the room, and when they're outside of therapy, that person, again, might in reality still not have any. So they did the drama, they have a reparative thing. My hunch is that something would have changed about, you still use the name Tommy, something changed about Tommy that the next time he interacts with critical mom in real life, that he'll have a different response, he'll be able to contain it, or he'll be able to pull up some more internal strength to be able to tolerate that.
Right. He might set better boundaries. He might distance himself from her. He might make choices, though, that are for his own good, that are for his health and his welfare. Because oftentimes, you know, kids who've come from traumatic upbringings, they don't do necessarily what's best for them, because they don't know how to do that. They're always sort of taking care of everyone else. That's what they learned. But they can't sort of stand up to take care of themselves. That feels very foreign to them. So hopefully through psychodrama, they could be able to do that more often and set better boundaries and put themselves first.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, let me go back to the example I used for when we were warming somebody up and with anxiety and then selecting a protagonist.
Yeah.
So the theme was anxiety. And so the group chooses the protagonist. And so say that protagonist wants to work on being able to make decisions. The anxiety freezes them. And so we might first start out and do a scene where we meet the person's anxiety on the stage.
Sure.
And something I always do at the very beginning, which is really important, is this idea of safety, is getting a support person for them so that nobody has to walk through their drama or their journey on their own.
Yeah.
So have them pick a support person to be with them as they go through this. It might be a friend. It could be God. It could be Superman. It can be whoever you want it to be.
The dog, whoever.
Right. It doesn't matter because it's psychodrama. And we've definitely enrolled dogs and cats and lots of action here on the stage as well. And so they have their safety person. We meet anxiety. They pick somebody from the group to play the role of anxiety, bring that group member up. And then remember, the protagonist, though, is in all the roles, right? And they're showing the auxiliary how to be.
Because these auxiliaries, the other people in the group, have never met, you know, their dad, their brother, their sibling, their coach, whoever, or and don't know what their anxiety looks like.
Right.
So, yeah.
And we'll call this person Mary. We're just making this up.
Sure.
So they haven't met Mary's anxiety. And so we then have Mary become her anxiety, interview her in the role of anxiety, tell us a couple of things about yourself. How long have you been around? When do you show up? What do you do? How close are you right now? Sculpt yourself in relation to Mary. Anxiety might be just pressing down on Mary's shoulders. And so we get a good sense that anxiety is causing her a lot of distress. She can't move, right? It's pressing down.
Yeah.
And then we reverse roles. Anxiety takes on the role. The group member who's been chosen presses down on Mary. We check in with Mary. Does this feel okay? Great. Mary then can have a conversation with her anxiety, or if she has trouble making a decision, I might say, you know, let's start with a decision you had to make recently. And so maybe Mary's having trouble deciding whether or not she should take a vacation. And she just gets stuck. But this is just one of many examples. She never can make a decision. And so she's trying to decide whether or not she should take a vacation, and we might even enroll vacation because that's the decision that she's struggling
with.
So the decision of taking a vacation, and she might go back and forth with decision of taking a vacation, and she's talking to it like, I don't know what to do. And vacation's like, you should come to Florida. It'll be so sunny. It'll be so bright. And she's like, but then I don't know if I have money, and what am I going to do with my kids and my mom? And then she just freezes. And it's because anxiety is pushing down on her shoulders. And so I might say, okay, turn to your anxiety. You know, and so then she might start talking to her anxiety. I can't talk to vacation because you're right here. You're strangling me. I don't have a voice when you're around. I need you to go away. You're always here. You know, ever since I was little, you're always strangling me. And so then I might say, take us back to a time where anxiety first came to strangle you.
Mm. Yeah.
And so then we go back in time, and maybe we go back to a scene at school where, you know, maybe she was bullied. Mary was bullied by maybe a student. It could be sometimes teachers can be bullying. But for this, let's make it a student. And so she goes back, and then we enroll Mary's little self. So say Mary was 5. We enroll the bully. We enroll the teacher. We set up basically the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
So we set the scene, and we actually create it on the stage. And so once it's set up, we meet all the other characters. And it might be that this bully, when he started to pick on Mary, maybe he was calling her names or something, that's when Mary first learned to just freeze. And we'd see that in action, though. So anxiety might come in and say, shh, just be quiet.
Yeah.
Don't talk. Right? And so we can see that scene. We can see what happened. And then what we can do is we can change it. Right? So we can pull adult Mary out and say, you know, Mary, what did this little 5-year-old need to have happened in the scene? And she said, well, someone needs to go, like, talk to her. You know, this bully is just being so mean. He's calling all these names, and no one's doing anything. Right? Everyone's kind of ignoring her. The teacher's not paying attention. And so then Mary has a chance then to do something that never actually happened in real life,
mm-hmm.
but can happen right now. And even though we're looking at a scene in the past, in psychodrama, it's actually happening again right now.
Sure.
It's as if it's happening in this moment. Everything's in the here and now. And so that's really important. And so Mary then has an opportunity to go back into this scene as herself, or she might say, you know, I want Superman to come in and rescue little Mary.
Yeah, absolutely.
And whatever it is, she can have it happen. And so little Mary gets to experience something very different than what actually had happened. So in this example, we're saying she was bullied and no one noticed her. Well, now someone's going in. They're noticing she's getting picked on. They might have a couple of words with the teacher who's not paying attention. They might, you know, tell that little kid to, you know, just go away and not be so mean. Maybe have a conversation with his parents. Whatever happens, it's very reparative. And again, because the body knows no time, all of this is getting processed through the body.
Sure.
And so for Mary, it's as if it is actually happening. And that's this healing part. And then in doing that, we're changing the relationship that she had with her anxiety. Okay. Because someone's coming in now to protect her and have it go differently. And so then what happens is after we explore the past and we clear out some of that, we're going to go back to the present and we're going to see if her ability to make a decision has changed any, because that's the mm-hmm. contract.
Right.
Right.
Because that's what she was – that's her initial thing that she wanted to look at.
Right. And so we go back to the present and I'll say, where is your anxiety now? And she might say, well, anxiety's still here, but it's not pressing down on my shoulders. It's actually about 10 feet away from me.
Yeah.
Okay, so we know we've already created some change because anxiety is not pushing down. And then we'll say, okay, so go ahead now and talk to vacation, you know, and see then if she's able to make a decision about that. And what you'd hope is that with the anxiety that has backed off a little bit, she'll be able to make a decision. And then that's the change that happens in the psychodrama, and that's what we want to see. We want to see that integration that occurs. And then hopefully we also see that then it generalizes, which again, it often does, that they'll then go out and they'll come back and they'll say, oh, I booked that vacation.
Yeah. Because that actual behavioral change.
Yes, because the spontaneity has increased and we move the anxiety away. And we also got a chance to understand what the anxiety was there for initially. The anxiety initially came on the scene when she was 5 to protect her.
Sure.
It was very protective. It's just not working for her now, you know, when she's like 35.
Yeah.
And so it's learning that and it's putting her in a different role, and she's taking on a new role of decision maker.
So it's a great example, and I'm glad you went into the detail that you did, because I really do think it really shows how complex it can go. It's not just put that person in the chair, have the conversation, and you're done. Because there's safety creating, there's the goals of the patient, there is exploring the origins, being able to redo something, and then, you know, testing how it changes the present. And being witness. So it's so many things.
I also want to talk about sharing.
Oh yeah. That's a whole good piece about the end of group.
Right. Because sharing is the final part of those three parts. So you have the warm up, the action, and then the sharing. And sharing allows the protagonist sort of reintegrate back into the group. Moreno's wife, Zirka Moreno, used to say that when a protagonist does a psychodrama, it's like they're taking off all their clothes. They're exposing themselves. They're making themselves vulnerable in front of the group. Mm-hmm. And so sharing allows them, she said, to put their clothes back on. And in sharing is very special because sharing is not a place where we give feedback to the protagonist, where we give any praise or criticism. So it might sound weird, but we're not going to say, oh my gosh, that was such a great job, or you did such a good job with that. It's really a time for each member to share with the protagonist about how they related to the drama, to any part of the drama. It might be to the relational piece with the protagonist and their anxiety. It might be difficulty making decisions. It might be, I got bullied when I was little. But it's always about them. So they would share from that place. I really related to you because when I was little, I also got bullied, and that was a really horrible time for myself. And I, you know, was really depressed when that happened. Or I really related to your struggle of not making decisions. I get stuck all the time, and my partner gets so mad at me and says, why can't you just decide? So it's all about the group member.
Mm-hmm.
And that again, is that healing component. I see yeah. you and I relate to you. This has also happened to me. And mm-hmm. that's very, very healing.
Both ways. I as person in audience or whatever, you know, I relate to you because of the bullying and I had that. So they're saying it to the protagonist. So they're like, oh, wow, somebody actually saw that. And the protagonist is seeing the person saying it. So it's both ways. People are being seen. People are being acknowledged. As opposed to, I think what a lot of folks do is avoid, don't talk about, ignore, cry in the bathroom stall, that kind of stuff, which maybe make you feel better moment to moment, but in the long term, you're stuck in those patterns, which is a lot of what psychodrama is exploring those and helping change those dynamics.
Right. And the learning happens in action. So the idea yeah. that we learn in action, we have to unlearn these things in action as well.
Absolutely. Let me ask you this. Do you think that there is any issue or any person or anything that would be not good for psychodrama?
No, I think psychodrama can really be used with anybody. So people have depression, anxiety, someone that just wants self-growth. It's used a lot with individuals with substance abuse. You can actually talk to your substance of choice and have a conversation with your heroine.
I have used that very technique in the substance abuse group I run.
That's awesome. I'm really excited to hear that you are using it. It's very, very powerful for substance abuse. There's a lot of substance abuse centers that use psychodrama. You can use it with individuals who have personality disorders. Moreno really wasn't big in sort of pathology, the idea of pathology. He always talked about underdeveloped roles. And so when we look at someone with personality disorder, we can identify them and what roles are overdeveloped or maybe underdeveloped and not look at it as a very pathological illness.
Yeah, like in that kind of diagnostic sense.
Right.
Sure.
You can use psychodrama for eating disorders. You know, it's very big. Have a conversation, you know, with the food that you don't want to eat, you know, yeah. you and the cheese, you know, what's that like?
Or a conversation with your body.
With your body, absolutely. Yeah. Have a conversation with your body. It's great for trauma.
Do you think there are any age limitations? Like I wouldn't do it below 7 or anything like that.
Yeah, so psychodrama can be used across the age span. You can use it with kids and adults, and there's different ways that we would use it with kids versus adults. And Rebecca Walters at Hudson Valley Institute did a lot of work using psychodrama with adolescents in inpatient settings. I use psychodrama in my social skills groups for kids, utilizing some role playing and having them problem solve challenges and conflicts in a different way. So we might play out you know, their parent telling them no and see initially how they might respond, which is, you know, with a tantrum and yelling and screaming. And then this goes back into the role training. What are some better ways that you can handle when mom and dad say no and have them practice that? So that would be an example of using psychodrama in that setting. So psychodrama is great really for anyone. And the group has been full of individuals with many different presenting problems and many different things that they want to get out of group.
We're going to get to the lightning round of questions, the final three questions that have nothing to do with whatever the topic is we're talking about. I wanted to know if you wanted to say any final things about psychodrama for those out there who this is maybe the first time they're ever hearing about it. You know, last things they should know or you'd like to get across.
Yeah, so I think if you're interested in getting insight into your behaviors, strengthening your interpersonal relationships, strengthening the relationship that you have with yourself, psychodrama can be a great modality to reach those goals. For more information about psychodrama, you can go to asgpp.org. It's the American Society for Group Psychotherapy and Psychodrama. And they actually have a couple of links to videos that will show you a little bit more about what psychodrama is about. Because here we are talking for an hour about psychodrama. But in psychodrama, we say, show us, don't tell us.
Absolutely.
And so I'd love if you're listening to check out some of those videos again at asgpp.org, the American Society for Group Psychotherapy and Psychodrama. And you can get more information about what is this what does this look like, yeah, and see if you're interested. There's also links to individuals who do psychodrama. So if you're interested in finding a psychodramatist near you.
Yeah. And you definitely want, as you noted earlier, you definitely want somebody who has had a decent amount of practice with this. You don't want somebody winging it because it is so nuanced and complex.
Right. So, yeah, no. So about that, if you are looking for somebody, you know, you want to ask some questions. How long have you been training? Are you certified? Are you getting supervised? Because there's a difference between someone who goes to one training and is doing a couple of techniques compared to someone who has hundreds of hours and is on their way to becoming certified. So you just want to make sure that the person that you're doing it with is conducting it within their scope of competence.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's our I was about to say nutshell, but 2 hours talking about psychodrama isn't really a nutshell. But that's I'm glad we got to talk about that. We went over examples. We went over a lot of the key ideas. We went over where it came from, and hopefully it stirs some interest in folks, and they look it up. You check it out, and maybe do some good work, because it's really, really powerful work. Now we move into the lightning round. So I have three questions for you. And I'm curious, because you don't just know a lot about psychodrama. You know a lot about a lot of things, and you have a lot of clinical training. So here's my question for you. What do you think is the core mechanism of change in therapy? If you boil it all down, you know, because we all have the different things. There's psychodrama, there's ACT, there's DBT, there's cognitive behavioral, there's all these different kinds, or psychodynamic, there's branches within psychodynamic. What do you think at the end of the day is the core mechanism of change in therapy?
I think it comes down, one, to relationships, the relationship that you have with your psychologist. Mm-hmm. That's critical. We know that from the research, that relationship is so important. Only when we feel safe in a relationship with our psychologist or our therapist are we able to even begin to look at the relationship we have with ourselves or with other people, because that we have to be vulnerable for that. And so we need to really have safety.
So you're suggesting the relationship itself is that's the main thing that's really creating the change, or maybe facilitates the change.
What Moreno would say, that we are catalysts of change for each other. So it doesn't necessarily matter the type of therapy, whether you're doing CBT or psychodynamic or interpersonal or humanistic. It's all built on relationship. And again, we get injured in relationship and we heal in relationship.
Okay. All righty. Question two is a two-parter. What do you think makes a quote-unquote good therapist good, and what do you think makes a bad therapist bad?
So one, I think some people have a knack for therapy. There's something just intrinsic within them that they just know how to do it. Mm-hmm. So even though you need training and you need all that, there's something that really helps them relate to other people. They might be really insightful. They might be really tuned into people. And you can learn that too, but there's some people that come ahead of the game. They come out of the gates already knowing some of this. So that's the first thing. I think some people really have a knack. And then training is so important, and continued training. So I used to think when you finish graduate school that you're done and that you know everything. I remember, you know, sitting in my college classroom in undergrad and looking at my professor and thinking, wow, my professor knows everything there is to know about psychology. That's why he's up there giving these lectures. And then as I got closer and closer to that ideal of what it meant to be a psychologist, I realized that no, he's just a few chapters ahead in the textbook, and he's still learning too. He doesn't actually know everything. And when I finished graduate school is when I realized that I just had a taste of everything, and now the learning really begins. And so Since graduate school, I've continued my training in many different areas, and I think that that's so important, that you're never done. And if you have a psychologist that says, oh, I stopped learning, you know, 10 years ago, I don't want to go to them.
Would you say that, like, for folks of like, oh, I haven't gone to a training in a while, but I have tons of experience? Again, because I this question for me is for most people coming into therapy don't know what is a strong therapist, what isn't. It's hard to know, especially if it's your first time out. So your metric is saying about, because a therapist might not say that, a psychologist might not say that, like, I've just stopped learning. So what would you say, advice-wise, based on that? Because I agree with you about you don't just stop and then it's just, well, you just get tons of experience. You have to continue to be linked to research and stuff like that. So how would you recommend that to somebody, like, just starting therapy, to be mindful of, or like a question they might ask the therapist?
When you're calling to get therapy services and or when you meet the therapist in person, you can ask them to tell you a little bit about their training and different populations that they've treated and, you sure. know, what their interest areas are, because that'll give you a lot of information. Some psychologists will just tell you, you know, I'm training in this therapeutic modality or the special treatment.
Yeah.
And that'll help you know as well if they're continuing on. I also think, you know, training is important. Not all psychologists are trained alike. So I think it's important to, you know, be a little curious about where do yeah. people train and, you know, what schools did they go to and what experiences have they had? Because that is going to enrich their ability to be able to help you heal.
Okay. So then the flip side of that question, what do you think makes a bad therapist bad?
I think a bad therapist would be one that isn't really tuned into you, that appears that they're not really listening, that they're not really paying attention that they need to make sure that they provide you really good care. You want a therapist that's really invested while they're in the room with you and also outside of session and trying to figure out different ways to help you and reduce the symptoms that you're having.
All righty. Yeah. So therapists, yeah, who were not paying attention to you, or hopefully at worst, although I have heard a horror story of, you know, a therapist falling asleep in session. Hopefully they're still connected to you and paying attention to you. Final question. If you could treat anybody that is a fictionalized character, so that might be in a movie, that might be in an opera, that might be in a book, who would you want to treat?
So one of the movies I really liked was Ordinary People, and I know that's a classic therapy movie, but the mom in that movie I'd really like to treat because she had a very difficult time after her son's death, and it really affected the whole system, but she wasn't able to tolerate all of the pain associated with that, and she actually left the family. And so to be able to meet with her and see what was going on for her and how the death affected her, and see if we could do some treatment with her to have her be able to tolerate what had happened and to take on a different role instead of the one of avoiding and leaving.
I that is still in my long-term viewing needs. It's in my Netflix queue. It's been there because it was recommended to me because it is a classic therapy movie because about family dynamics, and it had been first recommended to me in one of the family therapy classes that I took. So now I'm going to have to go back and remember this conversation and think about that more. In thinking about this, because I asked this of everybody, so I'm constantly thinking about, like, who'd be something I wanted to treat, you know, some watching TV and stuff like that. And Dr. McCosey, Mike, had suggested Michael Scott from The Office, played by, in the U.S. version, played by, actually, I don't know if he has the same name in the British one. I don't know. But Michael Scott, played by Steve Carell. And we were joking when we were talking when he was on the show about, like, oh, did he ever go to therapy? I don't know if that was ever part of the show or whatever. But in watching The Office recently and kind of jumping around and finally putting some more time into it, there actually is a scene where he sees another character who like, he hates on the show, Toby, where Toby's a certified, like, therapist, and they do counseling sessions. He has to do 6 hours because it's a longer story, but he has to do 6 hours because of a thing that he did. And it's actually, like, a really well-done therapy scene that's tolerable because I don't like most therapy depictions in Hollywood. But it's kind of funny and humorous where Michael's very resistant to engage. So he jokes and he says, you know, Toby's like, you know, you got to try to engage in this. And he goes, okay, yeah. And he's lying down. And he says, yeah, you know, I went to grab something from the freezer, and I went to grab, you know, the penis. Oh, I mean the peas. What do you think that means? you know, obviously just like being resistant. So Toby uses playing cards and doing like a puzzle to throw Michael off a little, to like, oh, so tell me about, you know, your dad and stuff like that. And that's when he starts to open up. So just having finally gotten into that show is just really hysterical. What was your response to that?
No, when you were talking about that, I realized there is actually an actual TV show that I would love to treat actually any of the characters on, which is Shameless on Showtime.
Oh, with William H. Macy, yeah.
Mm-hmm. That family is like the epitome of dysfunction. And so any of them would be fascinating to get into the therapy room. But that would actually be just a great family case.
Just the whole family?
The whole family, because everyone is struggling, and you can see sort of the generations of alcohol use, substance abuse, and all of that, but everyone is struggling in their own way, and it really creates havoc.
Awesome. Well, not for them, but well, that's it. So that is our you survived the lightning round. We talked about psychodrama. As I noted earlier, you know a lot of other things about a lot of other things, so we'll have you on the show again so we can talk about other things. And thank you for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really wonderful to be here, and I can't wait to come back and talk some more.
All right, we'll talk then. Thank you. So that's the show. That is the second half of this two-parter episode on psychodrama. Hopefully you enjoyed that. Maybe you have some questions. Maybe you've already started Googling things about it, looking in your local area of where to find a certified psychodramatist. I can always be found on Twitter. I am at 50MHPodcast. That's at 50MHPodcast. Feel free to tweet at me there. I write a lot about, of course, psychotherapy, psychology, wellness. I retweet articles. I go back and forth with other folks on there. So feel free to follow me. If you have a minute, if you got 10, feel free. It's always greatly appreciated to write a review on iTunes. That helps get the show out to more peoples, and more people are find out about the show. That's the show. Hopefully you enjoyed it. Enjoy whatever you're doing. And remember, together we're heavy.